So tonight's talk, I want to give a talk about how to harmonize with the five hindrances. The hindrances of sensual desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. So these five hindrances are really reactive patterns that show up in our meditation practice. They are a particular version of the afflictive mind states that Marcia was talking about the other night. So they either show up one at a time, or sometimes they show up as a multiple hindrance attack. And as Marcia was describing, when the samadhi, the concentration, deepens, there will be stretches of time when these hindrances are more quiet, and sometimes they're even fully suppressed. And then over our practice, through the process of awakening, these hindrances also become weakened, and eventually they start to uproot. And at the point of a full awakening, these hindrances have been fully uprooted. So for all of us here on this path, it is important for us to learn how to recognize them and work skillfully with them. Because probably for most of us, this is going to be a patient journey towards liberation. Before diving further into each of them, I wanted to share a little bit of context around this idea of harmonizing with the hindrances. So again, that's the title of my talk, How to Harmonize with the Hindrances. So the inspiration for this idea of harmonizing actually comes from martial arts, and specifically from the types like Aikido, which is purely used for self-defense. So I can't say I have a lot of personal experience. I'm not I don't practice Aikido, but I've just been really curious about it. And so I've done some reading, I've watched some videos. And what I've learned is that a core value of Aikido is to live in balance and harmony with all things at all times. I thought that was quite fitting for our practice. So an Aikido master will never be the one to attack. And if they are attacked, they will always practice bending, flowing, softening with the attack, rather than bracing or stiffening up against the attack or counterattacking. So in that way, they always seek to harmonize with the force of the attack, and when that energy of the attack comes at them, they'll have a way to flow with it and direct it back. So if we can imagine, I can only imagine because I haven't tried it, but I can imagine that in that way you can stay very grounded within your own energy. You're not actually losing any energy, because you're not expelling any energy. You're just flowing with the energy that's there, and you're finding a way to harmonize with it. And so there's this attitude of peacefulness and always making sure that the least amount of harm is done. That's sort of a core value of this art form. So I thought that this intent of being like a peaceful martial artist, or perhaps you could call it a peaceful warrior, or if you want, you could call yourself a peace activist, and that image might be really helpful for us in our work with the hindrances. Because very often, you may have noticed this for yourself, we get in a battle with these energies. We try to counterattack them, we try to really vigorously get rid of them, and that really doesn't go anywhere well. So if we imagine being a peaceful warrior, we would still take a strong stance to not let the hindrances overtake our practice when they come, but we would always relate to them with an attitude of peacefulness. So we would be seeking to end the inner battle that's stirred up with peace rather than with war. So that's the idea. So I wanted to share a few definitions I found around the term peaceful warrior from the first one is from the Urban Dictionary. So someone who is willing to fight for their rights, but are also willing to do it with peace and love. One who wishes to fight for peace is a peaceful warrior. And this is from the author Dan Millman, who has written about the peaceful warrior. And he writes, "What the term peaceful warrior means is living a form of balance. It's about living with a peaceful heart, but also acknowledging that there are times in our lives when we need a warrior spirit." So again, thinking about the work with the hindrances, I just think this, for me, it's an inspiration. I'm hoping it might be for all of you as well. So in this talk, I would like to offer three different ways that we can apply the principles of harmonizing with the hindrances. But before we dive into how we might apply these principles, I want to take some time to go through each of the hindrances. For some of you, they might be very familiar, and for some of you, this may be new information, so let's take some time to talk about what they are and what they look like in practice. The first hindrance is called greed or sensual desire. And with this particular hindrance, we desire or crave pleasant experiences through any of the six sense doors. So pleasant body sensations, pleasant smells, pleasant sights, pleasant taste, pleasant sounds, and even pleasant thoughts or fantasies. We crave them. The Buddha compared the mind overtaken by sensual desire. He used the imagery of a pot of water filled with different colored dyes. So we imagine right now we have a pot of water, but there's all kinds of different colored dyes floating around with that water. So if we were to try to see our own reflection in that water, we couldn't see anything with clarity. So the same way with sensual desire, when the mind is clouded with all of these colors, we can't actually see anything with clarity. So I think it's a little bit similar to the expression of having rose-colored glasses, you know, that we can't actually see any, we can't see things with clarity, or we can't see reality when we're wearing rose-colored glasses. So it's important for us to know that pleasant experiences such as like the pleasant taste of food or seeing the beautiful mountains here is not the problem. They're not the problem. It becomes a problem when we latch on to the pleasantness, when we want more of it, when we dwell on it, when we seek it, when we desire it. When we start, everything we do is about how can I get another pleasant sight or another pleasant cup of tea or more of that pleasant food I like. That's when it becomes a hindrance. So sensual desire can come up in many forms in our meditation. So a form most of us probably know is thinking about what are we going to have for lunch, fantasizing about that lovely food that Steve is making for us. And then when lunch is done, what kind of soup might we have to be, right? So this sort of fantasizing about something pleasant. Or we might plan a lot how we can have a very pleasant walk with lots of beautiful sights. So again, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the beauty here. It's when our energy starts to really collect around how can I have more of this pleasantness. And sometimes when we have a period of feeling really calm and relaxed and there's well-being in our meditation practice, then often we start planning our next retreat, right? So it's like, it's going so great, I'm loving it, I want to do more of this, I want to have more retreats. That's that greedy mind that desires more of those pleasant experiences. So energetically, in the body, it can feel like a leaning forward into the next moment. We cannot feel any sense of contentment in the here and now. Even when we're sitting and we're eating the most amazing food and it's lots of pleasant sensations, taste, when there's that greed in the mind, we can't actually enjoy it because the mind is already sort of, I want more of this. I want to secure this. I want to have this. So we can't fully just enjoy it. One difficulty with the hindrance of sensual desire is that it can actually be really hard for us to catch it in the mind. And one reason is that we're so programmed in some ways to believe that pleasant states is what it's supposed to be like. That's when it's the right experience. That's the natural state, is a pleasant state. Right? So when we have a stretch of pleasant, it's like, oh, finally, here we go. All that other stuff, all the unpleasant, that wasn't really supposed to be here, but now that this stretch of pleasant is here, now I finally have what life is supposed to be like. And so when the mind is in that a place of sensual desire, we may not notice it because it's like taken for granted. This is how it should be. A couple of years ago, my partner and I were watching a reality show called Alone, and it was a show about a group of people going into the wilderness. And they had to find their own food and catch their own fish. And so they went through a lot of hardship, you know, not getting enough food. And what was so interesting watching all of them, whenever they caught a fish, like they would obviously be very, very happy. And it was sort of like, now I got it. I turned a corner. From now on, every single day is going to be fish day. Every single day is going to be this pleasant experience I'm having right now. And of course, sitting back and watching them, it was like, no, tomorrow you probably will not find a fish because I've now seen. But it was just very interesting to watch that tendency of the mind to latch on to that pleasant experience, and then solidifying, now life is going to be like this. This is how life should be. And so my partner and I, whenever we would notice this in our own minds, we would start to say to ourselves and to each other, I got a fish. I caught a fish. Just as a way to notice that energy of like, okay, I got it now. Everything is perfect. What is very interesting to notice about sensual desire is that we often think that the pleasantness is in the object. We think that the pleasantness is in the lunch, for example. But when we look a little bit closer, we see that the pleasantness is actually not in the lunch, it's in our minds. Because we can see that our relationship with the lunch is changing all the time. That very same lunch, one day it might be very pleasant to us, and then the next day it's not as pleasant. So that's one way to work with this energy of desire. The second hindrance is called ill will or aversion. And when there's a lot of ill will and aversion in the mind, we're constantly picking up signs of disliking. In whatever we pay attention to, there's this disliking in the mind. So we have a negative evaluation of what we're paying attention to. We may dislike ourselves, find faults in ourselves, that's a form of self-aversion. We may dislike other people, judge them, evaluate them negatively. We may dislike the meditation, the instructions, the teachers, how our bodies are feeling in this moment. So again, with the energy of aversion, the mind is constantly, again, picking up signs of what it is against, what it is disliking. The Buddha compared the mind filled with aversion to a pot of boiling water. And we can actually sense into this, right? So this image of this water boiling and being really hot, when the mind is agitated and angry and irritated, that's a really good image for how the mind feels. And of course, again, we cannot see anything clearly with rapidly boiling water. There's no clear surface that we can see anything within. So the hindrance of ill will is often much easier for us to recognize as we are really aware that something is wrong. You know, when we feel aversion, it's like, this shouldn't be like this. That person shouldn't be doing like this. I shouldn't be like this. There's always this sense of something is not right. Aversion also includes fear, states of fear. And when we are fearful, we often can feel this energetic response of somatically pulling away, or there can be a sense of contracting inside of our bodies. So one of the most very painful experiences we can have is this ill will towards ourselves. And it can come up in the form of self-criticism. You know, where we're really being very hard on ourselves, like looking for things we're not doing right. There can even be this self-loathing where we punish ourselves. So when the mind is filled with aversion, either towards others or towards ourselves, it's often quite a lonely place. So sometimes when there's aversion, if we feel irritation and anger, sometimes there can be a strange initial pleasantness. We may feel righteous. We may feel, you know, a sense of powerfulness when we feel angry at someone or something. But what we often discover is that it also isolates us from others, this energy of aversion, whether it's a form of not liking self or feeling a lot of aversion towards others. There's often a strong sense of separation. When the mind is in a place of a lot of disliking, the world really feels like an unsafe place. You know, others are perceived as dangers when the mind is filled with a lot of aversion. The third hindrance is called sloth and torpor, and this can be felt as a sinking or heavy energy in the body and the mind. And sometimes we actually feel sleepy and drowsy. Other times it may manifest as more of a spacey, calm mind, but we can know it because as sloth and torpor, because we cannot find a lot of clarity within that calm mind. The mind is just not very clear. The Buddha compared sloth and torpor to a pot of water with moss and water plants growing all over it. So I thought, this is really a good image. You know, heavy, still, overgrown with mossy stuff. Did anyone have a mossy mind today? I think that's a great image. And as we can imagine, with this mossy water, like we can't see anything, and we can have a real felt sense of like, this mind is so cloudy and I can't see anything clearly. I'm just in this mossy space. So in practice, when sloth and torpor arise, we may notice it as we start drifting off our meditation object. And sometimes we altogether we forget what we're doing. You know, we get up from the cushion and they're like, I have no clue how I was practicing this last hour. That's when sloth and torpor can be strong. So we are so busy in our daily lives, multitasking and doing many things at a time. So it makes sense, right, when we settle down into retreat. You know, we're paying attention to something very subtle. Like this little area here, that's incredibly subtle compared to computers and phone calls and, you know, news and shopping. And there's a lot of stimulation in daily life. So of course, when we ask the mind now to go to something very subtle, It takes some adjusting to do that. And as the Buddha taught us, the really common reaction to more neutral experiences is spacing out. Right? So this is often, the breath is often a lot more neutral than all the stimulation in life that we're used to. So just to have compassion with the mind now doing a completely different job than what we're used to. And to take our times to, again, to balance our energies and not to judge ourselves too much. So where sloth and torpor is felt like a very quiet or sinking energy, restlessness is often felt like too much energy. So it can feel like a buzzing, vibrating energy in the body and the mind. And we can have a real difficult time sometimes sitting still. It's like there's just too much restlessness in the body and in the mind. And sometimes the mind gets really involved with excited planning for the future, or sometimes it has more of a quality of anxiousness, ruminations, worrying about the past or the future, regrets about things we may have done in the past. And this all leads to a spinning, restless mind. Sometimes repeating wrongdoings. You know, just repeating over and over again things that we regret. The Buddha compared the restless mind to a pot of water stirred up by strong winds. And today we've had some strong winds. So you felt this energy of, if you've been outside, this energy of the wind, right? So it's like pushing you in different directions, and that's that energy of the restless mind just pushing you in all directions. And again, we cannot see anything clearly when the surface of the water is stirred up by all of this restless energy. The last hindrance is doubt. And really, for many of us, this is the hardest one to identify as a hindrance. The Buddha compared it to a pot of water where there's a lot of mud from the bottom that's been stirred up, and so the water is unclear. And that's all those doubting thoughts that's making the mind unclear when the mind is full of a lot of doubts. So doubt often comes in the form of what seems to be a rational, clever voice, a voice that's questioning ourselves and questioning our own abilities to practice, questioning the way that we are practicing, and sometimes even if we should be practicing. Is this the right thing for me? I don't seem to be very good at this. Like, should I really be practicing? And very often we are very identified with this questioning voice. So again, to be bringing in compassion here, in our society, in our school system, in our lives, we are trained to question and analyze experience. Right? That's how we're trained, how these minds have been trained from the time we started school. So of course, when we come into meditation, we bring that conditioning with us. And so we ask critical questions, and we're just not used to just do as we're told. Like, we always question, why are we doing this? Is this the right thing? And we need that in a complex world, and it's not so helpful in meditation. So when the mind is really involved with a lot of doubt, it can feel like a standstill or a freeze. So we basically stop practicing because of the doubt. We spend more time thinking about our practice than actually practicing, because we're all the time, is this right? Am I doing it right? Should I be doing something else? And then we end up actually not practicing. The opposite of doubt is to have confidence in ourselves, our practice, and the bigger benefit of this path. And the paradox with confidence is that this practice actually calls us to continually be in a not knowing place, in a place of not knowing. So each moment is unique. This moment right here, right now, has never been here before. This moment is totally fresh, totally unique. So we cannot know what this moment, well, we can know we're in this moment now, but you cannot know what the next moment is going to be like or what this retreat is going to be like, because it's all the time, it's a fresh moment. Each moment is a fresh moment. So there's only one way we can be with this, is to be in a place of not knowing and be open to the freshness of experience. So in some ways, we learn how to trust the goodness of this practice, even though a lot of the time we may not know exactly what we're doing or what we should be doing. But we learn to trust this path and we learn to trust this practice and we learn to just say, can I just take on this practice? Because I trust the goodness of it. And I don't need to question it or analyze it or use a lot of that analytical knowledge to think about the practice. So now I want to return to this idea of being a peaceful warrior. And again, if this word peaceful warrior doesn't work for you, please don't feel you need to take it on if you want to, again, think about it as a peace activist, if that works better for you. But again, the peaceful warrior that's harmonizing with the hindrances rather than getting in a battle with them. So the first way that we can harmonize with the hindrances is through peaceful coexistence. So when the hindrances are not too loud or too demanding of our attention, we can, like a peaceful warrior, we can simply make a note of their presence in the periphery of our awareness, and then we can return back to our primary meditation object. So in that way, we're not pushing them away, and we're also not giving them energy, but we are peacefully coexisting with them. They're there, we're knowing them, they're in the periphery of our awareness, but again, we're not engaging with them. And in that way, we're saving our efforts for our primary object. And in some ways, this very it takes a little bit of effort for us to allow the hindrance to be in the background and still be with, for example, the breath. It takes a little bit of effort to be able to do that. But in some ways, that little bit of effort can actually really support the mindfulness and the concentration, because it gives a little bit of energy, like we need to rise to that situation. There's a hindrance. I see you, I know you, I'm not getting in a battle with you. Let's peacefully coexist, but I'm being with my breath here. That gives a little bit of energy that can actually really support the practice when we can allow it to be there without resisting it, but also not engaging with it. And as the concentration naturally deepens, simply due to the unification of the focus, at some point there's no room for the hindrances, because the mind gets so unified around our object that the hindrances will naturally fade away. When the hindrances get a little bit louder and more demanding of our attention, we can try to shift our approach to, I call it, balancing with antidotes. So this is the second way of harmonizing with the hindrances. So antidotes are skillful means that directly counteracts the energy of the hindrances by balancing out the particular energy of the hindrances. This will become clearer as we talk about it. Sometimes we stubbornly try to stay with the breath when there's a hindrance that's growing. We say, I'm just going to stick with my breath. I'm not going to attend to worry that's coming up or aversion that's coming up. And then we end up bracing and contracting around the hindrance. So this approach is based on aversion, actually, because we don't want the hindrance to be there, so we are averse to the hindrance, and then we often end up with a multiple hindrance attack, because as you know, what we resist persists, right? And I would say that what we resist persists, and it often escalates and multiplies. So when we try to work with a hindrance, with a lot of aversion in the mind. I don't want this hindrance to be here. I'm just going to stick with my breath here no matter what. There's a building of aversion that comes up and we're actually not seeing it because we so diligently try to stay with the breath. So when we try to balance with an antidote, we are maintaining a peaceful relationship with the hindrances. We're simply shifting and say, okay, now I need another skillful way of being here. Peaceful coexistence is no longer working, so let's try something else here. And in that way, we are flowing and harmonizing and bending with the energy of the hindrance. So with the hindrance of greed, with sensual desire, we are craving sensual pleasures through the six sense doors. The Buddha talked about how giving unwise attention to beautiful objects at one of the six sense doors is what gives rise to the arising and the growing of sensual desire. So it's like we see something pleasant and we keep looking for pleasant, or we taste something pleasant and now search for the pleasant. This is really what again gives rise to it becoming a hindrance. And so an antidote is to guard the six sense doors, as Marcia was talking about yesterday. So it's not about blocking input, we can't do that. The ear hears a sound, we can't just say no sound can come to the ear door. But it's about guarding, so it's about with mindfulness being aware that attention is being pulled out towards a pleasant sound, or attention is being pulled out towards a pleasant smell. Really just noticing how our attention gets pulled in all these directions. The second antidote is to mindfully give attention to the not so beautiful aspects of our experience. And this is called a supa practice in the Pali language. And there are a number of specific practices that one can do if there's a long-standing habit of a lot of sensual desire and you really want to work on that. And I won't get into those particular practices now. But as an antidote in our practice here, we can gently practice turning our attention away from what we perceive as really beautiful and then remind us of the not so beautiful aspects. So for example, a person's hair may look very beautiful to us, but if we found that same hair in a soup, it would no longer be so beautiful. The food on our plate may smell and look really delicious. At some point, it's going to move through the digestive tract. It's going to come out the other end, and that same food no longer smells so good and doesn't look so beautiful. This flower here, really beautiful. At some point, the leaves are going to wilt, they're going to fall off, and it won't have the same beauty anymore. So the point is not to get depressed or to deny ourselves of beauty. As we talked about, noticing beauty is not the problem. It's simply for us to be aware that even the most beautiful phenomena, what's most beautiful to us, is impermanent. It won't last. It has dukkha nature. And that's what we forget when we crave sense door experiences. We forget that these are impermanent experiences that has dukkha nature. So that's what we, in some ways, are reminded of. with the hindrance of ill will, aversion, as we talked about, the mind is picking up signs of disliking. An important antidote for aversion actually is metta. The Buddha says, cultivate the meditation on loving kindness. For cultivating the meditation on loving kindness, ill will disappears. So that's very clear. It's a direct way that we can counteract this energy of aversion, self-aversion, aversion towards others, and all the fear that's also a type of aversion that can also be counteracted with loving kindness. So with a regular practice of loving kindness, this energy of aversion tends to diminish over time, because we start to see ourselves and the world with kinder eyes. So when we notice here in retreat that there's a lot of disliking of self, of others, of basically anything, in that moment, if it's possible for us, we can say, can I actually see the endearing qualities here? Can I invite my heart to, instead of like, I don't like this, can I invite my heart to look at what is endearing, what can I appreciate, what can I befriend, how can I bring this attitude of loving kindness towards what I dislike? The antidote for sloth and torpor is to arouse energy in various ways. So we may go for vigorous walks, we can do standing meditation as we talked about. And it's also said that attuning to the perception of light and the sense of spaciousness can also be really helpful. So if there's a lot of sloth and torpor in the mind, we can practice with having our eyes slightly open in our meditation, and that way we're letting in some light, and that can be helpful. Practice outside to attend to the spaciousness of outside can bring, again, some energy into the mind. Another way that we can arouse energy is really to remember the preciousness of this practice. And in bigger ways, remembering the preciousness of this life, right? This precious human life, which is short, and we only have this much time to practice. As Marcia was talking about, it's really rare to be in human form if we believe in this idea that, you know, we can be born as animals, as ghosts, as all kinds of beings. This particular human form is a rare experience, and it's a rare opportunity for us to practice. And that might arouse energy. So one of my first teachers, who was also trained in Zen Buddhism, always had us chant something that would arouse this energy. So I'm just going to chant it for you, and you can see how it lands for you. So the chant is, life and death are of supreme importance. Life passes swiftly and opportunity is lost. Let us awaken, awaken. I will not squander my life. Some of you may know that chant. The antidote for restlessness and worry is to give attention to the opposite energies of agitation. So we talked about the idea of loosening the strings, right? So when the string instrument is too tight, it can give rise to restlessness and worry. So if there's too much of that, we need to loosen the strings. When there's a lot of agitation in the mind, and it often feels like the mind and the body are feeling constricted and tight. There's just too much energy in the mind and in the body. Like there's not enough space within us. So probably all of you have had times on this retreat or other times when there's been this sense of buzzing and the tightness inside. So we can practice giving this restlessness a bigger pasture to roam in. We can imagine that if there's too many animals in too small a pasture, they're going to get really agitated. Right? So we can practice giving our own minds a bigger pasture. And that way we can lessen the agitation. So what does that mean? It means backing off the effort a little bit, letting go of a tight focus on the breath, attuning to an overall experience of the body and breath, not getting so tight on the focus, seeing if it can release any unnecessary tension or tightness in the body, connecting with a sense of spaciousness, relaxation. Sometimes doing a lying down meditation can be really helpful, release some of that constriction. Gentle and mindful movement practice is helpful, and as we said many times, walking practice is very helpful. So with the hindrance of doubt, the immediate antidote is actually to get clarity. So that's a time to ask questions to the teachers when the mind is filled with doubt. Now you have the possibility in your practice meetings to bring in those questions to get clarification. And sometimes when doubt is like an ongoing thing, it can be really helpful to, even though we're not sure about which practice we should do, for how long, to in some ways just pick something. It's like coming out of that dilemma of all those questions and just say, okay, let me just do this. You know, so it may not be the most suitable practice, but it probably won't hurt you. And when we pick something and we just do it and we put doubt on pause, then we actually come out of the doubt. It's a way that we can come back into more clarity. The third way that we can harmonize with the hindrances is by deliberately making them our primary object of mindfulness. And this is often quite helpful when the hindrances are quite persistent. So again, if we can bring up the image with the peaceful coexistence, we're staying with our breath, the hindrance is sort of in the background, we're peacefully coexisting. When they become a little bit stronger, we can try an antidote to harmonize. And when they're really persistent, at some point we might say, okay, I'm just going to turn around and look right at you. And then we face the hindrance full on with our mindful awareness, and we are now befriending them by deeply getting to know them. In some ways, harmonizing with them by knowing them from the inside out, right? So really knowing the experience of a hindrance with our mindfulness from the inside out. When the hindrances become our primary object of mindfulness, they are just another thing to be known. Like any other phenomena that can be known in our practice, the hindrance now is just another phenomena. We're not judging, should it be here, shouldn't be here. We're just saying, okay, something to be known. And in that way, they can be grist for the mill for a mindfulness practice, another potential source of insight and wisdom. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha actually goes through each of the hindrances, giving us instructions for how to practice mindfulness with the hindrances. And I won't go through all of them, but it's the same basic instruction, so I'm just going to use the one he gives on ill will. So he says, when a meditator have ill will in them, they understand, I have ill will in me. When they don't have ill will in them, they understand, I don't have ill will in me. They understand how ill will arises and how, when it's already arisen, it's given up, and how, once it's given up, it doesn't arise again in the future. So with this instruction, we are advised to simply know the arising and passing away of each of the hindrances with the clarity of mindfulness. Just another thing to be known. Many of you are familiar with the acronym of RAIN, which was developed by the Vipassana teacher Michel McDonald. And this tool can be really helpful for us to bring clear and mindful knowing of the hindrances as they show up in our practice. So the R in the RAIN stands for recognizing what is happening. So the first thing we might notice is that we're entangled, or we're caught in something. We may not be able to name the hindrance, but at that point we can simply say, entangled, entangled, there's entanglement. That's enough. Because just naming it, saying there's entanglement, will arise, or will give rise to that mindful knowing, which will bring more clarity. And sometimes just naming it, labeling it, there's entanglement now, then we might be able to see with more clarity, oh, there's restlessness here, oh, there's doubt here. Then we might be able to name the hindrance. The A stands for accepting or allowing. So here we practice fully accepting that right now the mind is overtaken by a hindrance. So we may practice relaxing the body and the mind around the experience of feeling entangled. So it's like, okay, entanglement is happening. Let's not add further suffering to something that's already difficult. So we can take a few deeper breaths. You can even try it right now. Naming entanglement, taking a few deeper breaths, allowing the shoulders to drop, opening the palms of our hands, and perhaps silently saying to ourselves, I can be with this, I can allow for this, this is what's happening right now. Breathing, coming into the body, okay, entanglement is happening. So when there's a lot of hindrances in the mind, there's often a tightening around them, as we talked about, a lot of disliking of the hindrances. The Buddha often used the image of a tangle when he taught us about how we get caught in suffering states. So I don't know if any of you are knitting, are knitters. I'm not a knitter myself, I have done it. But if we can imagine yarn, right, we're knitting, and we have yarn that gets entangled. And then what we sometimes do when we're eager is that we start pulling at the corners of that tangle. And what will happen is that the tangle just gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And that's often how we relate to our own tangles. We pull the corners, desperately trying to get out of the tangle, and that will just lead to this deeper entanglement. So with this skill of allowing, by softening around it, there's entanglement happening that tangle can soften a little bit. And once it's softened, we can much better start to gently, patiently untangle the tangle. I stands for investigation. And here we are really practicing getting very curious about our experience. So we are stepping out of the storyline and coming into the here and now dimension of our experience. You know, so let's say we're in a storyline of doubt. I can't do this practice. I'm no good at this. This is probably not the right practice for me. Once we have named it, entanglement is happening, allowing it, okay, it appears that there's doubt. We step out of the story of, I'm not good at this, this may not be the right thing for me, or is this the right thing for me? And then we feel, how is this felt in the body right now? This energy of doubt or this energy of aversion. What urges to act does it prompt? You know, if there's aversion, do I want to write an angry note? Do I want to write an angry email? What are the impulses to act that comes along with it? Does it stay at the same level? Does it fluctuate? And what's that quality of the inner dialogue of the mind? So instead of going with the content of the story, we're getting interested in the phenomena of doubt or the phenomena of ill will. And the body is always in the here and now. So the stories about our life is often about the past or the future. When we release the storyline, we come into the body, it's a direct doorway into a here and now experience. Because the sensations of the body are always unfolding in the here and now. So that's a way to come out of that entanglement. It's just, again, taking a breath, coming back and down. How is this felt in the body right now? N stands for non-identification. So when we are entangled with our mind state, we often see it as a direct reflection of who we are. So let's say there's anger arising. Often we then say, oh, I'm an angry person. There's a moment of anger, right? There's a coming together of anger. And we notice the anger, and now we say, oh, I'm an angry person. That's right, I'm an angry person. I've actually always been an angry person, and probably I'll continue always being an angry person. So in that moment, we're not seeing that there's probably many more moments of not being angry than there is of being angry. We are solidifying, identifying, making an identity around anger. So anger, like anything else, is arising out of certain conditions, and it falls apart when those conditions change. So just like a rainbow arises out of certain conditions, when those conditions change, that rainbow will disappear. In the same way it is with all the things that move through our mind. So a rainbow is really real when it's there, right? It's definitely, we can see it, we can appreciate it. And anger is really real when it's there, but there's no core rainbow and there's no core angry self anywhere. And that is what we're seeing, or that is what we're practicing with when we're practicing non-identification. Stepping out of the I am this and seeing it as an impersonal, impermanent phenomena. The Buddha gave a really good instruction in this, a very simple one. I've used it many times in my practice when I felt entangled. So the instruction is, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. So, not sure if you can feel how powerful that is. Right? But that, even that, in the middle of the tangle, you can go right there, say to yourself, oh, right, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And it may have the effect of immediately releasing some of that identification. I had more I wanted to say, but I'm seeing that I am running out of time. And this is also a lot of information to take in one night. So, I want to just go to the ending. And I'd like to end tonight's talk with coming back to the image of the peaceful warrior. And I'm going to read some key values and principles from Aikido. And again, you can see if those principles and instructions for how to practice, if any of this can be helpful for you and how you relate to the hindrances. In order to harmonize with the laws of nature, we must first learn to develop and maintain the right attitude of training. We must always keep the attitude of becoming one with every situation. This is an attitude of respect for all things at all times, regardless of the situation, friend or foe. One must always be ready to harmonize. So to practice this, this again comes from Aikido. Adopt a neutral, non-aggressive, relaxed stance. Maintain a 360-degree mindful awareness. Don't clash with your opponent's strength or meet it head on. Move with it or around it and use it. Blend with your partner's movements by matching and mirroring the speed and timing of the confrontation. Stay connected with your center with abdominal breath. Remain physically and mentally relaxed and awake. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for listening to the Dhamma.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.